Let's come to order. Please go on the record. I am Commissioner Kimberly W. Duffley, and with me today are Chair Charlotte A. Mitchell and Commissioner Daniel G. Klotfelter. I now call for hearing docket number EMP 116 sub-zero in the application of Juno Solar for a conditional certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct a 275-megawatt solar facility in Richmond County, North Carolina. On July 12th, 2021, Juno Solar, Juno or applicant, filed the application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity with confidential exhibits and confidential pre-filed testimony of Piper Miller. On July 27th, 2021, the applicant filed revised pre-filed direct testimony of Ms. Miller and a revised site plan, as well as other supplemental confidential exhibits. On July 27th, 2021, the public staff filed a notice of completeness as required by Commission Rule R8-63D with respect to the completeness of the application. The notice of completeness also included a motion to stay, which was denied. On August 31st, 2021, the Commission issued an order scheduling hearings, filing of testimony, establishing procedural guidelines, and requiring public notice. On September 1st, 2021, the Commission staff sent a letter to the State Clearinghouse requesting comments on the application. On October 4th, 2021, October 11th, 2021, and October 15th, 2021, the Clearinghouse filed comments on the application. On September 14th, 2021, the applicant filed supplemental direct testimony of Piper Miller. On October 15th, 2021, the applicant filed unredacted copies of both the direct and supplemental testimony of Piper Miller. Finally, on October 19th, 2021, the applicant filed an exhibit entitled Statement of Need, originally filed as confidential with the application and testimony in unredacted form. On October 12th, 2021, Duke Energy Carolinas and Duke Energy Progress jointly filed a petition to intervene, which was allowed. On October 28th, 2021, the public staff filed a motion to cancel public hearing, which was granted. On October 26th, 2021, the public staff filed the testimony and exhibits of Dustin Metz, utilities engineer, and the public staff's electric section. On November 9th, 2021, the applicant filed rebuttal testimony and exhibit of Stephen J. Levitis and the rebuttal testimony and confidential attachment A of Piper Miller. In compliance with the State Ethics Act, I remind all members of the panel of our duty to avoid conflicts of interest and inquire at this time as to whether any member has a known conflict of interest with respect to the matter coming before us. Let the record reflect no conflicts were identified. I will now call for appearance of counsel, beginning with the applicant.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Karen Kimmerite. I'm an attorney with Fox, Rothschild & Raleigh, and I'm here on behalf of the applicant, Juno Solar, LLC.
Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Ben Snowden, also with Fox, Rothschild, LLC here in Raleigh on behalf of the applicant.
Good morning.
Layla Cummings and Robert Josie, public staff on behalf of the using and consuming public.
Thank you. Good morning. Do the parties have any preliminary matters before we begin?
Yes, we have just one preliminary matter that I wanted to make the commission aware of. Steve Levitis, we are going to be presenting Mr. Levitis and Ms. Miller as a panel, and they are going to provide their direct and rebuttal testimony at the same time. Mr. Levitis has a flight where he's planning to leave here at 2 o'clock. I've made Ms. Cummings and Mr. Josie aware of that schedule, and we don't think that it's going to be any problem to have him his testimony concluded in time for him to leave for his flight.
Okay, thank you. Any objection? Okay, so allowed. Any other preliminary matters?
No.
Okay, and as with respect to the confidential information.
Sorry, I do have some confidential questions that I believe we can save until the end, but just wanted to make the commission aware of that.
Okay, thank you. So indicate when you plan to ask your questions with confidential information. Okay, hearing nothing further, you may call your first witness. Okay.
I'll begin by calling a panel of Juno Solar's witnesses, and the panel will consist of Piper Miller and Steve Levitis. And I'll begin with Ms. Miller. Ms. Miller, can you state your full name and business address for the record?
Sure. My name is-
Actually, we need to, do you want to swear or affirm both witnesses? Which would you prefer?
Do you have a preference, Ms. Miller?
Nope.
Okay.
Okay, is there a Bible, left hand on the Bible? Why don't we do both witnesses at the same time? Do you solemnly swear to tell that the testimony you're about to give this morning will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God.
Thank you. Ms. Miller, I'll ask the question again. Can you state by whom you're employed and in what capacity?
Sure. My name is Piper Miller. I am the Vice President of Development for Pine Gate Renewables.
And can you also provide your business address for the record?
Yes. My business address is 130 Roberts Street, Asheville, North Carolina, 28801.
And did you cause to be pre-filed on July the 2nd of 2021, 24 pages of direct testimony in the form of question and answer and exhibits, and specifically exhibits 21 and 22 and confidential exhibits 13 and 14?
Yes.
If I were to ask you the same questions that appear in your direct testimony today, would your answers be the same?
Yes.
And did you also cause to be pre-filed on July the 26th of 2021, 24 pages of revised direct testimony in the form of question and answer, and exhibit 21 and confidential exhibit 21A?
Yes.
And if I were to ask you the same questions that appear in your revised direct testimony today, would your answers be the same?
Yes, it would.
And did you also cause to be pre-filed on September the 14th of 2021, 6 pages of supplemental direct testimony in the form of question and answer?
Yes.
And if I were to ask you the same questions that appear in your supplemental direct testimony today, would your answers be the same?
Yes.
And then finally, did you cause to be pre-filed on November the 9th of 2021, 18 pages of rebuttal testimony in the form of question and answer?
Yes, I did.
If I were to ask you the same questions that appear in your rebuttal testimony today, would your answers be the same?
Yes.
At this time, I would move that Ms. Miller's pre-filed direct, revised direct, supplemental direct, and rebuttal testimony be copied into the record as if given orally from the stand, and that the exhibits to her testimony be marked for identification and included in the record.
Any objection? Hearing no objection, motion's allowed.
And Ms. Miller, do you have a summary of your testimony that you would like to present to the commission at this time?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Please go ahead and read it.
My name is Piper Miller, and I am the Vice President of Development for Pine Gate Renewables. Juno Solar is wholly owned by Birch Creek Development and operated in collaboration with Pine Gate Renewables, which is managing the development of Juno Solar's proposed utility-scale solar photovoltaic generating facility. I filed direct testimony and exhibits in this docket on July 12th and 13th, 2021, revised direct testimony and exhibits on July 26th and 27th, 2021, supplemental direct testimony on September 14th, 2021, and rebuttal testimony and exhibits on November 9th, 2021. The purpose of the summary of my testimony is to demonstrate that Juno Solar's conditional CPCN application meets all requirements of North Carolina General Statute 62-110.1 and Commission Rule R8-63, and to explain why the Commission should grant the CPCN with the proposed conditions. In my testimony, I provide information about the 275-megawatt Juno Solar facility in Richmond County, North Carolina, and explain 1, the need for the Juno Solar facility, 2, how the Juno Solar facility with the associated network upgrades will serve the public convenience and necessity, 3, why a conditional CPCN is needed for the facility, and 4, how the conditions to Juno Solar's CPCN application will provide ample protection for the North Carolina ratepayers from unreasonably high network upgrade costs. In my testimony, I emphasize the importance of the Juno Solar application for the state, especially in light of the recent enactment of House Bill 951, Due to the mandate in House Bill 951, there will be a substantial need in North Carolina for new non-carbon emitting generation on the Duke Energy Progress and Duke Energy Carolina's system. I also explain how the requested conditional CPCN provides an appropriate solution for an unintended problem that the Duke Energy FERC Q reform study process created for Juno Solar, a FERC jurisdictional interconnection customer. The Juno Solar site consists of 25 parcels, collectively containing approximately 2,586 acres of land, located along McFarland Road and Green Chapel Church Road in Richmond County. In both my supplemental direct and rebuttal testimony, I provide substantial evidence of the need for the Juno Solar facility. Juno Solar has executed a preliminary term sheet from a large investment-grade retail and wholesale energy supplier in PJM that demonstrates the need for the renewable energy from the facility in the Dominion region of PJM. This term sheet represents equal or greater evidence of need than was deemed sufficient for CPCN approval in several recent proceedings, including those of Fern Solar, Halifax Solar, American Beach Solar, and Sumac Solar. In addition to the executed term sheet with the retail and wholesale energy supplier in PJM, I provide information about the need for the Juno Solar facility in the state and the region. Commercial and industrial demand for clean energy in the PJM market is stronger than ever in the market's history and continues to grow. The year 2020 once again saw strongly increasing C&I demand for renewable energy, despite the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic. Level 10 Energy, which matches renewable energy buyers and sellers and provides insight into nationwide renewable PPA pricing, noted increasing solar PPA prices in PJM over the past 2 years in its Energy PPA Price Index, which has continued into 2021. PJM exhibits the highest solar PPA prices of any organized market in the country, with Level 10 finding a 25th percentile PPA price of $37.50. A price likely driven downward by clustering of PPAs at the discounted AEP Dayton hub and higher at the Dominion hub at which Juno will settle, underscoring the need for renewable energy in the region. Level 10 Vice President of Developer Relations Rob Collier stated in the company's Q4 2020 report, quote, "The convergence of more challenging local and state permitting regimes, prohibitively high grid upgrade costs, and a surge in buyer demand has resulted in a PJM market that is short in project supply, which has in turn led to rising PPA prices," unquote. PJM is expecting peak load growth of 0.3% for the next 10 years and 0.2% over the next 15 years, with a summer forecasted peak of 153,759 megawatts in 2031 and a winter forecasted peak of 135,568 megawatts in 2031. In my rebuttal testimony, I provide further information about the need for the facility in light of the enactment of House Bill 951. Due to the mandate in House Bill 951, there will be a substantial need in North Carolina for non-carbon emitting resource generation on the Duke Energy system to serve load to reduce emissions by 70% over 2005 levels by 2030. The 70% decarbonization by 2030 mandate means that a massive amount of solar energy resources will have to be added to Duke Energy's system over the next 9 years. In the Commission's recent order in the Integrated Resource Plan proceeding issued on November 19, 2021, the Commission found Duke Energy's 2020 IRPs that show the amount of solar additions to be at least 9 gigawatts to be adequate for short-term planning purposes. Thus, while the exact amount of solar additions will be determined in the carbon reduction plan to be developed by the Commission next year, it is highly likely that Duke Energy will be adding a minimum of 1 gigawatt of solar per year throughout the next decade. Under House Bill 951, 55% of that amount will be owned by Duke Energy and procured through facility purchases from third parties or by self-development. In addition, there is no size cap on the Duke Energy-owned solar, which means that the least cost mandate of HB 951 will almost certainly drive the procurement of larger facilities with greater economies of scale. There are currently only 5 solar facilities in DEP and DEC's combined interconnection queues with a capacity greater than 150 megawatts. In light of transmission and other development constraints, it is very likely that Juno Solar would be one of the most cost-effective options for Duke Energy to achieve compliance with House Bill 951. Also, in my rebuttal testimony, I provide information that the Juno Solar facility, along with the associated network upgrades, are in the public convenience and necessity. I discuss the substantial benefits that the development of the Juno Solar facility will provide to DEP ratepayers. These benefits distinguish Juno Solar from the other merchant solar projects interconnecting in the Dominion PJM region of North Carolina, about which the commission has recently expressed concern. In order to wheel its output from its location in DEP territory to PJM, Juno Solar will have to procure point-to-point transmission service across the DEP system. This process is known and transparent, with current and forecast rates being published by Duke Energy periodically. The current rate for firm point-to-point transmission service across the DEP system is $1,738 per megawatt per month. Reserving transmission capacity of 250 megawatts would result in approximately $5.2 million per year in new point-to-point transmission revenues to DEP at current rates. These revenues contribute towards DEP's annual transmission revenue requirement, or ATRR, and are used by DEP to operate, maintain, and upgrade its transmission system. By contributing substantial revenues towards the ATRR, Juno Solar can be expected to reduce the burden for transmission spending that would otherwise ultimately fall on DEP's various load customers. These transmission rates are forecasted by Duke Energy to rise substantially in the coming years. In my rebuttal testimony, I projected that Juno Solar will spend over $275 million on point-to-point transmission over the life of the project. This is the only means by which Juno Solar can deliver power to the PJM marketplace. These costs, not in any way reimbursable by ratepayers, will, under any reasonable assumptions, far exceed the cost of network upgrades which ratepayers might be subject to. Even at the high end of a $4 per megawatt hour levelized cost of transmission, Juno Solar's projected contribution of point-to-point transmission revenues to DEP still exceeds its reimbursable network upgrade costs by roughly a factor of 5. The magnitude of these new transmission revenues for DEP is a benefit entirely sufficient to allay any concerns over ratepayer exposure to interconnection costs. In addition, in my direct testimony and rebuttal testimony, I explained the reasons why the commission should issue a conditional CPCN to Juno Solar. As background, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has approved revisions to Duke Energy's Attachment J, Standard Large Generator Interconnection Procedures, to their joint open access transmission tariff. With FERC queue reform, Duke Energy has reformed their generator interconnection queuing, study process, and cost allocation process by transitioning to a definitive interconnection study process. Juno Solar has recently entered the transitional cluster in which Juno Solar and other interconnection customers will be grouped together for the transition cluster study process and will be able to share any required network upgrade costs. There are substantial and increasing financial security requirements required for both ready and non-ready interconnection customers to enter the transitional cluster and proceed the transitional cluster study process. The total security required for the transitional cluster study process, if readiness is provided, is as follows. 1x the study deposit to enter phase 1 and $3 million to enter phase 2. The total security for the study process, if readiness is not provided, is as follows. 1x the study deposit plus $3 million to enter phase 1, and an additional $2 million for a total of $5 million to enter phase 2. Therefore, ready projects will have to pay in excess of $3 million to enter phase 2 study, and non-ready projects will have to pay in excess of $5 million to be studied in phase 2. If an interconnection customer withdraws prior to phase 2 of the transition cluster study process commencing, no withdrawal penalty is imposed and the interconnection customer will only be assigned its allocated study costs. However, after the commencement of phase 2, the interconnection customer runs the risk of having to pay a withdrawal penalty equal to 9 times its study costs, which is likely to be $1 to $2 million or potentially greater, in addition to losing the study costs already paid. Among the reasons that an interconnection customer might need to withdraw from the study process is if the commission were to deny a CPCN application. The commission could decide to deny a CPCN where it believes that the LCOT for any network upgrades are too high. This situation creates a catch-22 for FERC jurisdictional interconnection customers like Juno Solar that have to enter the transitional cluster and must make substantial financial posting and face substantial withdrawal penalties if they exit the study process because the commission were to deny the CPCN. But Juno Solar cannot determine the amount of its network upgrade costs and its LCOT without first completing the study process. The solution to this unfair situation is for the commission to issue a conditional CPCN that will remain in effect so long as the LCOT for any required network upgrades assigned to Juno Solar is at or below an acceptable defined amount. Juno Solar has conducted a detailed injection analysis of the project to identify anticipated transmission overloads and potential network upgrade costs. The study found that minimal network upgrades will be required, and Juno Solar believes that the LCOT for any required network upgrades assigned to the project will be no greater than $4 per megawatt hour. Finally, I explained in my direct and rebuttal testimony that the conditional CPCN will ensure that the ratepayers are not subjected to unreasonably high network upgrade costs. Juno Solar has proposed a conditional CPCN that will both provide protection to the ratepayers and allow Juno Solar to enter the transitional cluster and incur the associated financial exposure without an unacceptable level of uncertainty about whether the CPCN will be issued and whether the issued CPCN will remain in effect. Juno Solar has proposed the following conditions to the CPCN to ensure that there will be no unreasonable harm or risk to the ratepayers. One, the LCOT for any required network upgrades assigned to Juno Solar will be no greater than $4 per megawatt hour. Two, the conditional CPCN will automatically terminate if the LCOT for any required network upgrades is greater than $4 per megawatt hour. Three, Juno Solar will agree not to seek reimbursement for any Duke Energy affected system upgrade costs that may be incurred. And four, Juno Solar's CPCN will automatically terminate if Juno Solar does not either contract for the sale of energy or the sale of the facility during the life of the CPCN. This information concludes the summary of my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. I'll now move on to Juno Solar's second witness, which is Steve Levitas. Mr. Levitas, can you state your full name and business address for the record, please?
I'm Steve Levitas. My business address is 130 Roberts Street in Asheville.
By whom are you employed and in what capacity?
I work for Pine Gate Renewables. I'm the Senior Vice President for Regulatory and Government Affairs.
And Mr. Levitas, did you cause to be pre-filed on November the 9th of 2021, 18 pages of rebuttal testimony in the form of question and answer in one exhibit?
I did.
And if I were to ask you the same questions that appear in your rebuttal testimony today, would your answers be the same?
They would.
At this time, I would move that Mr. Levitas' pre-filed rebuttal testimony be copied into the record as if given orally from the stand, and that the exhibit to his testimony be marked for identification and included in the record.
Any objection? The motion is allowed.
So Ms. Miller and Mr. Levitas are now available for cross-examination.
I do have a summary.
Oh, excuse me. Let me back up. Mr. Levitas, do you have a summary that you would like to read to the commission?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Steve Levitas. I'm Senior Vice President for Regulatory and Government Affairs at Pine Gate Renewables. I filed rebuttal testimony and exhibit in this docket on November 9th, 2021. The purpose of the summary of my testimony is first to explain the importance of finding a solution to the catch-22 problem for merchant plant projects seeking a certificate of public convenience and necessity, such as Juno Solar. Second, to provide information that the commission should follow its precedent by applying the levelized cost of transmission or LCOT test to Juno Solar's conditional CPCN application to determine the reasonableness of the network upgrade costs. Third, to explain that the public staff is fundamentally changing its position in this proceeding about the appropriate test for determining the reasonableness of network upgrade costs. And fourth, to demonstrate that the proposed conditions to Juno Solar's CPCN application will provide ample protection for the North Carolina ratepayers from unreasonably high network upgrade costs, while at the same time not subjecting Juno Solar to huge financial penalties in the event of the denial of the CPCN application in the future. In my testimony, I first discussed the catch-22 problem for FERC's jurisdictional interconnection customers, such as Juno Solar, that wish to enter into the transitional cluster study process, but must make substantial financial postings and face substantial withdrawal penalties if they are required to exit the study process solely because the commission denies a CPCN for the facility. I explained that I was extensively involved in Duke Energy Progress and Duke Energy Carolina's FERC jurisdictional queue reform stakeholder process as one of the primary spokespersons and drafters on behalf of Carolina's Clean Energy Business Association. I attended almost all of the stakeholder meetings. I was intimately involved in developing and negotiating solutions for issues that arose with respect to Duke's queue reform proposal, and I drafted detailed comments on and revisions to the various iterations of Duke's proposed modifications to the state and federal interconnection procedures. During multiple stakeholder conferences, these were mostly teleconferences, all of which I believe were attended by representatives of the public staff, I explained the catch-22 problem for FERC jurisdictional interconnection customers. I pointed out that a FERC jurisdictional interconnection customer that enters phase two of the transitional cluster study must make a substantial performance security payment and subject itself to a substantial withdrawal penalty well in excess of $1 million and perhaps more like $2 million if it exits the study process. Among the reasons that an interconnection customer might need to withdraw from the study process is if the commission were to deny a CPCN application or revoke a CPCN. In the Friesian Holdings CPN's proceeding, that was docket number EMP 105-0, the commission made clear that it will, in some circumstances, deny a CPCN for a FERC jurisdictional interconnection customer where it believes that the LCOT for required network upgrades assigned to that interconnection customer, which under Duke's FERC approved OATT and large generator interconnection agreement are reimbursed in part by North Carolina retail customers, are deemed to be too high. However, the interconnection customer cannot know its network upgrade costs and thus its LCOT until it has been through the transitional cluster study and will not even have an estimate of those costs from Duke until the end of phase one of the study process. Thus, the catch-22 is as follows. Duke cannot provide the finalized network upgrade costs of a FERC jurisdictional project in the transitional cluster study until after completion of the phase two study. But if the commission's CPCN decision for the project is not made until after those costs have been determined in phase two study, and the remaining phases of the study process, and the commission then denies the CPCN because it deems such costs to be unreasonable, the customer runs the risk of having to pay a withdrawal penalty equal to 9 times its study costs, which is likely to be, I believe I said in my testimony, 1 to 2 million. I think it's likely to exceed 2 million. That result would be unjust and would likely discourage FERC jurisdictional interconnection customers from participating in the transitional cluster study, thereby reducing the potential to spread the very large cost of resolving Duke's significant transmission system constraints and removing a major impediment to achieving the goals of House Bill 951. On several occasions during the stakeholder process, I explained the problem and then proposed two solutions. The first solution was to modify the interconnection procedures to allow a FERC jurisdictional interconnection customer to withdraw from the study process without penalty if the commission were to deny its CPCN application based on the network upgrade costs assigned to the project. Duke made it very clear that it would not support this approach, understandably, because any such withdrawal might require restudy of the remaining projects in the cluster study, which would adversely affect those customers. My alternative proposed solution was the one presented in Juneau's CPCN application, that the commission issue a CPCN conditioned on its reimbursable network upgrade costs coming below a specific and reasonable LCOT value. No stakeholder, including the public staff, at any time raised any objection or concern about the conditional CPCN solution that I proposed. In my testimony, I explained that both the public staff and the commission have identified LCOT as the test for evaluating the reasonableness of reimbursable network upgrade costs for FERC jurisdictional interconnection customers. Specifically, in the Friesian order issued on June 11, 2020, the commission noted, I'm quoting, public staff witnesses Lawrence and Metz argued that a levelized cost of transmission analysis provides a tool to evaluate the reasonableness of the upgrade costs associated with certain generating technologies. They cited to a 2019 study by Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory that reviewed interconnection cost studies for renewable energy facilities on a nationwide basis, doing so by calculating an LCOT value, end quote. The commission proceeded to state that, and I quote again, the commission views the LCOT analysis performed by the public staff as a benchmark of the reasonableness of the network upgrades relative to other similar transmission investments made to interconnect generating facilities in North Carolina, end quote. In addition, in the commission's November 13th, 2020 order granting a CPCN to the proposed Edgecombe Solar Merchant Plant, docket number EMP 101 sub-zero, the commission again used the LCOT metric to assess the reasonableness of upgrades required to the DEP system by the project. The commission concluded that an LCOT of $6 per megawatt hour for such upgrades, plus the cost of unreimbursed upgrades in PJM, was not unreasonably, sorry, quoting here, not unreasonably out of line with the 2019 Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory interconnection cost study on which the commission has relied to place LCOT calculations in perspective with data from other balancing authorities, end quote. The commission further concluded that, quote, in view of the total cost of the facility, the siting of the applicant's facility in this area is not consistent with the commission's obligation under NC General Statute 62-110-1D for the provisions of reliable, efficient, and economical service in the state. Commission also relied on an LCOT analysis to determine the reasonableness of upgrade costs in orders granting a merchant CPCN in docket number EMP-114 sub-zero and renewing merchant plant CPCN, a merchant plant CPCN in docket number EMP-92 sub-zero. In none of these instances did the commission consider the cost of upgrades that might be associated with other proposed projects, except to note where upgrade costs might be shared with such projects. Furthermore, during several conversations I have had with the public staff, I have asked them directly what their test is for CPCN issuance to FERC jurisdictional projects, and they have repeatedly confirmed the position that they took in the Friesian proceeding, that reasonableness of network upgrade costs should be determined based on a comparison of the project's LCOT to industry benchmarks. Exhibit one to my testimony is an April 22nd, 2021 email from the public staff that states, quote, as we have discussed before and stated in testimony, we consider the LCOT a benchmark for reasonableness of network upgrade costs. In my testimony, I note that the public staff is attempting to fundamentally change its position and the commission's position in this proceeding. The public staff seeks to prevent the commission from determining a reasonable LCOT value for Juneau Solar by arguing for the first time that even if the LCOT for a FERC jurisdictional customer's reimbursable network upgrade costs are reasonable by industry standards, it might nevertheless be appropriate for the commission to deny a CPCN for the project. Specifically, the public staff is suggesting that it might be appropriate to deny such an application if either the total cost of the project's assigned network upgrades or the total cost of reimbursable network upgrades for all FERC jurisdictional projects in the transitional cluster are deemed to be unreasonably high by some undefined standard. The public staff's position is a complete reversal of the position it has repeatedly taken in the past. The public staff has repeatedly acknowledged that the commission may not, consistent with FERC's crediting policy, deny CPCNs to all FERC jurisdictional projects simply because any reimbursement of network upgrade cost by ratepayers would be required. Rather, the public staff has advocated that the commission must apply some rational and reasonable tests, such as LCOT, in making such decisions. The effect of the public staff's new position would be that the commission could arbitrarily deny CPCNs to large merchant plants relative to smaller projects, even if the required upgrade costs were reasonable by industry standards. Or the commission could impose an arbitrary limit on the number of permissible FERC jurisdictional projects because of their aggregate impact. In my opinion, neither outcome is constitutionally permissible. In my testimony, I emphasize that Juneau Solar has proposed reasonable conditions to the CPCN to ensure that the ratepayers will not have to provide reimbursement for unreasonably high network upgrade costs and any affected system costs. Juneau Solar's proposed condition will ensure that the LCOT for any assigned network upgrades from the study process will be no greater than $4 per megawatt hour. Thus, with a conditional CPCN, Juneau Solar will be able to enter the transitional cluster study process and incur the associated financial exposure without an unacceptable level of uncertainty about whether the issued CPCN will remain in effect, and the conditions to Juneau Solar CPCN application will provide ample protection for ratepayers from unreasonable network upgrade and affected system costs being passed on to them. This is a reasonable solution that presents absolutely no risk to ratepayers. This concludes the summary of my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Levitas. Ms. Miller and Mr. Levitas are now available for cross-examination.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Levitas. Ms. Miller. My name is Leila Cummings, I'm an attorney with the public staff. Today, Robert Josie and I, my colleague, both plan on asking you both questions. I'm mainly going to direct my questions at Mr. Levitas, though, and Mr. Josie will direct his questions to Ms. Miller. And I'm going to go ahead and start off knowing the time limits we have for Mr. Levitas with Mr. Levitas. Before we start, though, I think it might be easiest. We passed out a packet of cross exhibits everyone should have. If I can go ahead and mark those cross exhibits for identification. On top of the packet is attachment J to the Duke OAT. This is the standard large generator interconnection procedures. I would request that this be marked for identification as public staff Levitas cross exhibit number one.
So marked.
Second one in the packet should be Duke's filing in FERC docket ER21-1579, filed on April 1st, 2021. This is the interconnection queue reform filing at FERC. I would ask that this be marked as public staff Levitas cross exhibit number two.
So marked.
The next document is the direct testimony of Kenneth J. Jennings, which is from the same FERC docket ER21-1579, also filed on April 1st, 2021. I request this be marked as public staff Levitas cross exhibit number three.
So marked.
The next document is the comments in support of queue reform filing, also filed in the same docket, FERC docket ER21-1579, filed on April 19th, 2021. This is comments in support of Pine Gate Renewables. I would ask that this be marked as public staff Levitas cross exhibit number four.
So marked.
Next document is motion for leave to answer and answer of the North Carolina Utilities Commission and the Edgecombe Solar Complaint Docket, FERC docket number EL2173, filed on June 30th, 2021. I request that this be marked public staff Levitas cross exhibit number five.
So marked.
Should also have a presentation entitled Transitional Cluster Phase One Customer Engagement Meeting dated November 29th, 2021. We request
Cummings, I do not have that document.
Struck out extras. Sorry about that. Yes.
Sorry.
Ms. Cummings, do you have one for the back table?
We'll get some more printed. I think we are short.
Okay, thanks.
Apologize. We ask that that document be marked Public Staff Miller, Cross Exhibit Number 6.
So marked.
I also do not have that attachment. Oh, are you bringing it, Robert?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And last, you should have a copy of responses to public staff data request number 2, dated October 4th, 2021. We request that be marked as public staff Miller Cross Exhibit Number 7.
Ms. Cummings, should we remark these as public staff Miller Cross Exhibit Number 1 and then the second exhibit, public staff Miller Cross Exhibit Number 2?
Yes, Presiding Commissioner, definitely that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, so marked. Yes, clear for the record.
And just a note on that last one, public staff Miller Cross Exhibit Number 2. There is a attachment that's marked confidential, but that confidentiality has been waived, so it's not confidential.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Levitas. How are you doing today?
Good. Good morning to you.
So I'm going to start with your rebuttal testimony, and you only filed rebuttal testimony. So to the extent I refer to your testimony, that's what I'm referring to.
Understood.
On page 3 of your testimony, beginning on lines 16 through 17, you state that Juno is at risk of incurring enormous financial penalties in the event of the denial of a CPCN in the future.
Right.
And on page 4, lines 18 through 19 of your rebuttal testimony, you state that the withdrawal penalty will be in excess of $1 million if Juno exits the study process after entering phase 2. Is that correct?
Correct.
If the project is studied in phase 1 and withdraws after receiving the final system impact study for phase 1, the phase 1 report, what are the withdrawal penalties, if any, under section 7 of the large generator interconnection procedures, which I've marked as public staff cross exhibit number 1.
Sorry, if the project withdraws after phase 1?
Before phase 2.
Yeah, there's not a penalty exactly. There's a requirement that the project pay its applicable study costs. The study deposit is $250,000. Presumably that represents a reasonable estimate by Duke of what those costs will be, although I believe that could be for the entire study process. So there may well be a refund after phase 1 if the project were to withdraw. The problem comes up after phase 1.
Mm-hmm. And the Duke FERC filing that is marked as public staff Levitas cross exhibit number 2, Duke states that as part of the TCS, they have provided a second customer engagement window at the end of phase 1. Giving interconnection customers time to decide whether to make the more significant financial commitments to proceed through phase 2 of the transition cluster and to meet the increasing readiness milestones. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
And in the same filing, Duke states that the transition cluster study process was designed to incent any speculative projects to withdraw after phase 1 report before the utility undertakes more detailed and time-intensive phase 2 study process.
I'm going to take your word for that. I don't know where in the document.
I'm happy to point you to it.
I'll take your word for it.
And in the same FERC filing, the testimony of Ken Jennings, which is marked as public staff Levitas cross exhibit number 3, Ken Jennings filed testimony on behalf of Duke. If you turn to page 23 of that testimony, In this section of the testimony, Mr. Jennings is describing the transitional cluster study process. And on lines 7 through 8, he states that interconnection customers withdrawing after phase one will only be required to pay actual study costs and will not be subject to penalties.
That's right. That's what I just confirmed.
And on lines 10 through 12, he says a customer withdrawing beyond the phase two customer engagement window will be obligated to pay withdrawal penalties. Then in the last paragraph, starting on page 16, he states that the downside of this approach is that it will likely result in restudy, but that was a compromise that resulted in overwhelming consensus with stakeholders and support for filings made with state commissions in North and South Carolina. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I was a party to that consensus.
So starting on page 7 of your rebuttal testimony, you rebut witness Metz's assertion. So I'm on page 7. Line 19, beginning that question and going on to the next page, page 8. You rebut witness Metz's assertion that a conditional CPCN will not solve the problem you describe as catch 22. Specifically, you describe that Juneau will receive an initial estimate at the end of phase one, at which time, if it is above the $4 LCOT condition, it will withdraw. You then state that the large generator interconnection procedures allows a project to withdraw if they go over 25% of the upgrade costs identified in phase one.
Correct.
And here you are referring to section 4.7.1 of the large generator interconnection procedures, which provides that 25% exception to withdrawal penalties past phase one into phase two.
Subject to check on the section number.
And I'm happy to point you to that in the exhibit one if you'd like. Yeah.
No, I'll take your word for it.
Okay. In Ken Jennings' testimony, he describes the additional circumstances a customer may withdraw without penalty. So this is page 43 of that cross exhibit 3 we were just looking at.
Sorry, which page?
43.
Okay, I'm there.
He states that there are a number of circumstances where a withdrawal penalty would not be imposed. And that includes if the project elects to withdraw from the interconnection project and the withdrawal does not have a negative impact on other interconnection customers, and where the withdrawing interconnection customers assigned system upgrade costs did not significantly increase between phases of the study.
Right.
So returning to your rebuttal testimony in that section I was just on regarding the LCOT, you say, it's page 8, lines 11 through 15, you say if an increase of less than 25% in Juneau Solar's phase one allocated network upgrade costs would cause its LCOT to exceed $4 per megawatt hour, Juneau would likely withdraw from the queue at that point without penalty rather than risk the possibility that a subsequent increase in its network upgrade costs could cause the CPCN to terminate.
That's my testimony.
And so just to be clear on that point, if Juneau receives a phase one report in excess of $3.20, it'll likely withdraw.
I think there is a high likelihood of withdrawal in that circumstance because should there be an increase in excess, by the way, I didn't do the math, but I think your math's right. Should there be an increase that is less than 25%, Juneau would not be able to withdraw without penalty, but would be subject to revocation of its CPCN. Now there is that other off-ramp that you referenced relating to no impacts on other projects, but that is, in my opinion, very unlikely to come into play with Juneau given the interdependencies in southeastern North Carolina.
So you've mentioned it in your summary and in your testimony. You're familiar with the LBNL study that the public staff has referenced in the Friesian case and the commission has referenced in several AMP cases. And do you recall that in that study, the PGM average LCOT was $3.22?
That sounds right. I haven't looked at it in a while.
I can point you to that if you'd like. And the commission uses this study, or has in the past, as a benchmark of reasonableness, as you've also described.
Yes.
At this time, Presiding Commissioner Duffley had asked that we take judicial notice of the Friesian Order and the 2019 LBNL study referenced therein.
Any objection?
No objection.
Well, without objection, we'll take judicial notice. Thank you.
Mr. Levitas, if the commission or the public staff were in the future to look to a more up-to-date cost information study, something along the lines of the LBNL study, but with more recent data, do you believe, given the trends you have witnessed in PJM, that those costs would stay the same or go up or go down?
Well, I don't hold myself out as an expert on interconnection costs, but I do have a fair amount of exposure to that issue and read the trade press a lot. And it certainly appears that those costs are going up. I don't know if that answers your question. But I will say, in response to your question, just to be clear about kind of my testimony and position, I have no objection to the idea that that the market benchmarks that I refer to and that you and the commission have referred to may change over time. And so that's why we have kind of accepted the public staff's point of view that there shouldn't be written into rule a bright line standard that's universally applicable, and that the decisions should be made on a case-by-case basis, but that they should be made on the best information that's available at the time.
Thank you. That does answer my question. Turning now to page 6 of your testimony. In a transitional cluster study, a withdrawing interconnection customer would be subject to a significant withdrawal penalty, you state, of 9 times the total study cost after phase one. That's pursuant to section 7.2.6 of the LGIP, correct?
Correct.
Except as the off-ramps described earlier.
Right.
And down further on page 6, you state the possibility of this penalty will discourage projects from participating in transition or definitive interconnection system impact studies. For Juno, if you elected to participate in the first definitive interconnection study, do you know what the withdrawal penalty is for withdrawing after phase two?
I haven't checked that, but I'm pretty sure it is significantly lower than the transitional cluster study penalty.
The study deposit, or 3 times the actual allocated cost of the study project at phase two, and 5 times at phase three.
Yeah. I will say that there are significant public interest considerations, in my judgment, for moving this project through the transitional cluster study rather than waiting for DISIS.
Turning now to the stakeholder process, you discuss some beginning on page 7, on line 1. You state that during multiple stakeholder conferences, you described what you call a catch 22 and you proposed 2 solutions. In discovery, when asked for the dates of those meetings, you said those meetings were likely in February, March of 2021.
That's right. I don't have any contemporaneous records of those calls. I know one of them I took while driving down I-40. I do have a bit of email documentation that would help kind of frame those, and I'm sure Duke has a record of when those calls occurred and who participated.
These were meetings 15 and 16 of the Key Reform Stakeholder Group, and the 2 meetings held prior to the FERC filing, but after the North Carolina filing for Key Reform. And they were held on February 3rd and March 16th. Does that sound correct?
It sounds right.
And there's been a total of 17 Key Reform meetings.
That's right.
So this proposal was pretty far down the road in the Key Reform stakeholder process. Is that fair to say?
Which proposal?
Your 2 proposals to the solve the catch 22.
Do you mean did I present them late in the process? No, I think I first identified them fairly early in the process. Well, while we were working on the state jurisdictional queue reform, it was a Duke's decision, understandable decision to work on the state proceedings before making a filing at FERC. It was sequential, but we were certainly contemplating the FERC procedures at the time that we were working on the state procedures, in large part because I think there was a recognition that solving this pressing problem of relieving transmission constraints on the Duke system was going to likely require a mix of state and FERC jurisdictional projects. So I, anyway, and I think others were thinking about how the two interconnected. I did go back and last night to try to see if I had any other email records beyond the one that's Exhibit 1. And I did find one set of email exchanges between myself and you and Mr. Dodge that dated back to November 23rd, 2020, and we appeared to have had a conference call on December 4th, I believe. So I think these issues were on my mind as early as then.
And if your counsel doesn't mind, can we get a copy of those communications?
Sure.
You state in your testimony that the public staff did not at any stakeholder meeting express objection, but you raised your concern. Can you say whether any stakeholder echoed your concern?
I can't say for sure about that. I was the major spokesperson for the development community on many of these calls, and so I was typically speaking for a larger group than just myself. My recollection is that on the second call, I specifically addressed the public staff and with the intent of trying to confirm that there was not an objection or a problem from the public staff side with respect to what the problem that we were trying to solve.
And on that second call, do you recall if any public staff attorney was on the line?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure on all the calls there were public staff representation, but I couldn't say for sure.
Those two meetings, meeting 15 and 16, February 3rd and March 16th, the topic of those meetings was to discuss changes, draft changes, to the LGIP and the LGIA. Was that correct to your recollection?
That's correct.
Did you add any of your concerns to the agenda for those meetings?
I don't know that I was given an opportunity to provide agenda items. I don't recall that I did that. I was having conversations throughout this time, as indicated by the email traffic, not only with the public staff, but with Duke, because I personally was very committed to trying to get queue reform approved. It was an extremely time-consuming, difficult, complicated process, and there was quite a lot of disagreement of opinion about the concept generally and the details of the proposals within the solar development community. I think it's fair to say that I was the most active participant in trying to work with Duke to achieve consensus and to make this important transition the way the queue is managed in Duke service territory. So towards that end, it was the highest priority thing that I was working on in that period of time, and I was talking to lots of people in trying to find common ground. And in particular, with respect to the FERC procedures, this problem that we're dealing with, this so-called catch-22, as I described, there were two possible solutions. One solution would have required that the FERC rules, the FERC procedures, be changed. And Duke was actively seeking our support for what they were going to file at FERC. So what was on my mind at the time, what I communicated was, if we're going to support these changes at FERC, then we need to have a solution to this problem, because if it's going to be Plan A, which is a withdrawal right, that would need to be written into the FERC procedures. On the other hand, the conditional CPCN solution was within the control of the commission and wouldn't require any change to the procedures. So I was very concerned that we have an understanding about how we were going to solve this problem, because if the answer was we've got to change the FERC procedures, then I needed to know that before I put my name on a document supporting those procedures. And as I've testified, Duke, in my opinion, understandably, did not think the no penalty withdrawal option was in the public interest or a good idea, which left us with the conditional CPCN solution.
When you proposed these two solutions, did you interpret the lack of objection from the public staff as approval?
I certainly had the expectation, particularly when I had indicated what I just said, that our support for these procedures was contingent on developing a solution. I had the expectation that if the public staff had a problem with what I was proposing, that you would let me know.
And did the public staff give any explicit or written feedback to your proposed solution?
I don't recall that occurring in the calls that we were just referring to. I do think that in some of the calls, and there were many, I feel like we did have some explicit conversations about the contingent CPCN. I think the sure if it's in exhibit one or this other. In exhibit one, to my testimony, you'll see that that began with an email to you and Mr. Josie of April 2021. And in the initial email that I wrote to you, I did explicitly refer to the conditional CPCN application. And I say, of the sort we have discussed, So it's an indication to me that as of April 21st, we had been talking about this idea, and I'm quite sure that you had not communicated an objection to me to the concept.
But do you assert that there was any communicated approval?
I can't make that assertion, no.
And for these stakeholder meetings, Duke solicited feedback in all its stakeholder meetings via an email inbox it set up and posted responses to those requests for feedback on its OASIS website. Did you submit a request along the lines of these proposals?
No, I'll have to plead technological incompetence. I had countless communications with Duke and other stakeholders about these procedures. I did not use that portal as a vehicle for those communications. There's all kinds of emails and other communications.
And other than in connection with this EMP application, have you made any filings before this commission or FERC detailing CCBA's position or Pine Gate's position that a conditional CPCN would be needed to accommodate projects entering a cluster study?
I don't believe so.
At the time the FERC filing was made by Duke in April of 2021, Pine Gate filed comments in support of Q reform. This is our exhibit 4. Is that correct?
That's right. Duke was, I think, encouraging that other parties weigh in and support in the hope that we would be able to expedite approval at FERC.
Pine Gate supported Q reform even after the meetings in which the public staff did not respond to concerns you raised.
That's right. As I said, my assumption at the time was that the solution to the problem that I had identified was that we were going to be able to utilize a conditional CPCN procedure and not need to modify the FERC procedures. So we were comfortable supporting the procedures on that basis.
Okay, turning to a different topic. On page 5 of your testimony, you state that this commission will deny a CBCN based, quote-unquote, solely on the fact that FERC's crediting policy requires the utility to reimburse the customer for network upgrade costs. Is that correct?
For network upgrade costs that are deemed to be unreasonably high by industry standards.
And that's a qualification you're making now, not in your testimony.
Can you point me to what you're
referring
to my testimony?
Page 5, line 14.
Yes, that appears to be sort of an abbreviation or shorthand for what follows later, because I think elsewhere and throughout my testimony, I make clear that what the commission has actually utilized is a reasonableness test based on LCOT. So it's not my intention to suggest that that the commission has denied or suggested it would deny a CPCN solely because there are reimbursable costs. And to the contrary, I've suggested I think it would be unlawful for them to do so.
Understood. But you, with your qualification earlier, you believe they would solely deny a CPCN such as Juno's based on the cost?
Based on LCOT.
I would like to turn to what I pre-marked as public staff Levitas cross exhibit number 5. That's the North Carolina Utilities Commission motion for leave and answer filed in the Edgecombe Solar complaint FERC docket EL21-73. Do you have a copy of that?
I do. I've not seen this before today.
Are you familiar with the Edgecombe complaint at FERC?
I'm aware of it, yes.
On page 4 of this exhibit, the commission states, and this is the under the headline B, the third sentence, the NCUC has not adopted any rule, guidance, or practice that would require denial of a CPCN simply because the cost of network upgrades would be allocated in part to retail customers.
I'm sorry, where are you?
I'm on the third sentence under B.
I see that.
And further down.
And I don't disagree with that.
Further down, when discussing the Friesen order, the commission says that it can consider all costs as, and this is the last sentence of that page, as one of the many factors to be weighed when determining whether generating resources needed and is appropriately sited at the location proposed by the CPCN applicant.
Was there a question?
Is that, do you think the commission has taken a different position than that in any docket?
Well, I note above that that this filing says that the NCU's orders speak for themselves. And I do think the Friesen order speaks for itself. And I don't think that what's cited below is what the Friesen order says.
On pages 10 through 12 of your rebuttal testimony, you argue that the public staff is changing its position by suggesting the commission consider the total cost of network upgrades for one project or the total cost of network upgrades for the transitional cluster. Has the public staff before considered a CPCN application for an AMP, to your knowledge, that is participating in a transitional cluster study?
No, there hasn't been a transitional cluster study. I will say on that point, in terms of my testimony regarding the public staff's position, I had been persistent over a 2-year period in trying to ascertain the public staff's position as to the applicable test for merchant plant certification. And as evidence in Exhibit 1 to my testimony, one of the more recent times where I put that question to you, the response, and I feel like you may have been getting a little bit understandably impatient with me because I kept asking the question so many times. What you said to me on April 22nd of this year is, as we have discussed before many times, that's my words, many times, stated in testimony, we consider the LCOT a benchmark for reasonableness. So, yes, it is my testimony that if you're now asserting that there is a different test for reasonableness, that is a change in position and a departure from what you have communicated to me on multiple occasions.
On page 12 of your rebuttal testimony, you state that as a procedural matter, the public staff seems to have some vague concern about whether Juno Solar can be held to the agreed upon conditions of the CBCN, even though Juno Solar has expressly proposed and agreed to them. Can I ask what the basis of this assertion is?
Yes, I think we responded to that in response to a data request. And I was reminded as we were responding to your data request that was communicated in a conversation that we had, I think in connection trying to understand the nature of the public staff's concern or opposition. And so it certainly does not appear in Mr. Metz's testimony. And if that issue is sort of irrelevant or inappropriate for consideration here, I don't need to pursue that, or if you have to talk to my lawyers about striking it. But I didn't, at the time that we were preparing the testimony, I was conflating things that Mr. Metz had said with things that had been said elsewhere. That was said in a phone conversation.
I think it's, from our perspective, appropriate just to clarify that that's not based on anything in the record.
Fair enough.
On page 16 of your rebuttal testimony, can you read the first sentence starting on line 1?
Beginning Juno Solar?
Yeah.
Juno Solar was sited at its proposed location for the express purpose of seeking to help solve what is arguably the biggest impediment to large-scale solar development in the state, and in my opinion, the biggest obstacle to achieving the carbon reduction mandate of House Bill 951.
And just to explore that a little, Juno was purposely sited in this area to resolve the congestion associated in the southeastern area of the state.
To help do so, yes.
Are you in that assertion speaking to the Frisian upgrades?
To the upgrades that were the subject of the Frisian proceeding, yes, that would serve many projects besides Frisian, yes.
But you're speaking to
the significant transmission constraints on Duke's system in southeastern North Carolina and northeastern South Carolina.
You go on page 16, lines 6 and 7, to say that Duke has confirmed the importance of these upgrades to its system planning. Can you explain how Duke has confirmed these upgrades are important to system planning?
I think we provided, in response to your data requests, references to and perhaps copies of the Duke comments that were filed in the Frisian proceeding, where I think they made statements to that effect.
Are these upgrades, to your knowledge, needed for reliability purposes?
I'm not a reliability expert, and I believe there may be testimony suggesting that they're not needed in some sense for reliability purposes. My own view is that when not a single megawatt can be added to a significant portion of the grid serving two states, that there's probably a need to upgrade that portion of the grid for reliability purposes, but I'm not an expert on reliability.
On the same page, lines 18 through 20, you say Pine Gate and its development partners have actively sought to identify and develop projects like Juno Solar that could participate in the cost sharing. Can you tell us what other projects are in the TCS owned or being developed by Pine Gate and its partners?
I would need for Ms. Miller to respond to that question.
At this point, I would just say that we have several projects in the transitional cluster across the DEP system. There are probably too many to name individually, but we could file an exhibit after the fact if helpful. And you know, not necessarily all of those are specifically for the express purpose of those costs. Some of them are just to help serve both you know, the needs we're expecting through House Bill 951 and a lot of the renewable energy mandates. And we feel that solar siting in the DEP system is you know, easier and less complicated than the DEC system, where it is much more challenging to site projects of that size.
And if I could add, Ms. Cummings, I've been on something of a mission for the last several years to try to solve what I believe is one of the most significant problems facing our state today, which are these transmission constraints in the southeast part of the state. Because I believe, as someone who's worked for a long time in the solar industry, that we cannot achieve the governor's goals of decarbonization without getting these upgrades built. Frisian Solar came before this commission with one possible solution to that several years ago, which was to allow a federal project to go forward. There would be reimbursement of the upgrades. Other projects would benefit. That proposal was rejected, understood. Once that occurred, I then said, well, now what do we do? And I said that to members of the public staff. And the solution to how we solve this problem was to move forward with a cluster study process with Q reform, which is a large reason why I devoted so much of my time for over a year to Q reform, so we could get Q reform procedures in place, get a cluster study process in place, get as many megawatts into that cluster study as possible to spread those costs, some combination of state and federal projects, so we could finally break this logjam and move the state forward. And we talked about that many times, and the public staff specifically said to me, I asked the question, this is what I'm going to go do now. Plan A didn't work. Do you agree that that's the right approach to solving this problem? And I was repeatedly told, yes, that's what we think should happen. Let's have a large cluster, spread the megawatts as much as we can. And it was understood there would be, unlike the Frisian case, where a federal project was going to get reimbursed for all those costs, in Plan B, there would be a mix of state and federal projects that would participate in funding those upgrades. Yes, the federal projects would be subject to the crediting policy, but there would be a lot of state megawatts in there that would significantly reduce the impact to ratepayers resulting from the crediting policy. So that's what I've been trying to make happen for now for a couple of years. And having this project participate in the transitional cluster study, in my belief, is essential to that strategy having a chance of working.
It is possible, though, that this log jam created in this particular area could be solved in subsequent clusters.
It is theoretically possible, but there are several problems with that. One is time. So we're going to lose a year in coming up with a solution. And that means costs are likely going to go up. Achieving the goals of 951 are going to be impaired. But we also don't know how that may complicate things. And I think, you know, I think in the Frisian proceeding, Duke's comments indicated that if we could just get this problem solved, everything becomes so much easier. And not wait a year or 2 years to solve it, but find a way to get it solved now. And that's what I've been trying to make happen.
Turning to page 17 of your testimony, lines 10 through 11, you're speaking to the Frisian case, which of course you participated in. You say that the public staff did not argue, let alone put on any supporting evidence that the network upgrades at issue were unneeded or inefficient. Is that correct?
I did say that.
And you're, of course, familiar with Mr. Metz, who's a witness today, and Mr. Lawrence's joint testimony in that proceeding?
I am. I haven't gone back and looked at that lately, so I probably was going on memory from that.
Presiding Commissioner Duffley, I would ask at this time that we take judicial notice of Lawrence Metz's joint testimony in docket EMP 105.
Without objection, that is allowed.
Thank you. On page 14 of your testimony, you say, under the CPCN that Juno seeks, if its calculated LCOT ever exceeds $4 a megawatt hour at any time before the execution of an interconnection agreement, the CPCN would automatically terminate.
Correct.
How frequently will Juno update the commission on its LCOT calculation?
I'm glad you're asking that question. We've been talking about that a lot and want to be sure we're very clear about that. And Ms. Miller may want to add to this, but we think it would be appropriate for there to be a condition on the CPCN that requires Juno to provide updated information in real time immediately upon receipt of any updated information, both with respect to the total interconnection costs and the LCOT calculation using the public staff's methodology, which you provided with us, provided to us, so that that occurs in real time and that would result in the CPCN automatically terminating. I would just also note, and I think it's in Ms. Miller's rebuttal testimony, when we made the initial filing, we proposed the idea of not quite so automatic a termination and that perhaps we could come into the commission and say, well, it was just a little bit over $4. Maybe you should give us a break and reconsider. And we've withdrawn that request. So we're now proposing the $4 megawatt, dollars per megawatt hour as a bright line test with no avenue for relief.
Thank you for that clarification. The CPCN, if it automatically terminates, does it do that by its own terms or will that require an order from the commission, in your view?
Well, I would leave that to the commission. There might be some value in having that in the record for interested parties to know that that CPCN had terminated, but it would be ministerial. We make the filing. There's no debate about whether it should happen. It just would happen.
And has Juno determined that if the LCOT goes over $4, whether it would even say the CPCN terminates, just as you described, would it continue in the transitional cluster study process?
Again, Ms. Miller may have some thoughts about that. I don't think so. I think if the CPCN is not issued or terminates, it's going to be very difficult for this project to go forward because of the uncertainty about its certification status. And, you know, I think at that point, Miller talked about the 951 compliance. I think it becomes a lot more likely, maybe somewhat likely today, but it becomes a lot more likely that this project becomes a Duke acquired project under 951.
And Duke, obviously they'll file a carbon plan and this commission will determine, will approve that plan after stakeholder input. But in your opinion, or how you know, might represent Pine Gate or CCEVA going forward, do your organizations think there will be competitive solicitations in the nature of CPRE going forward for PPAs and asset acquisition type how this facility might fall under a utility owned?
Yes, I can tell you what I think as somebody who spent a lot of time working on House Bill 951. First of all, there will have to be different procurement, maybe somewhat similar, but different procurement because of the different ownership structure created by 951. PPAs will no longer be competing with utility-owned projects, so there'll be silos or separate procurement of those two types of assets. The bill does not speak in the same way that House Bill 589 did with respect to competitive procedures, but it does have a least cost requirement, which leads me to believe that it's likely that there will be competitive procurement. Again, EPA is being procured in one bucket and utility-owned assets being procured in another. None of that, of course, has been established or defined yet, and I don't think there's anything in the legislation that prevents Duke from going out tomorrow and saying, we need to get to work and buying a project like Juno.
One thing that may be preventing Duke from doing that is there's not a carbon plan yet developed.
That's true. You know, I'll leave it to Duke to decide how they interpret the bill. But I mean, the one thing I will say is it's just hard to overstate the time urgency if this goal is to be achieved, because there has to be an enormous amount of procurement that occurs in a very tight time frame to have any chance of achieving the governor's goals and the legislature's goals.
And these silos, as you envision it, Juno could probably only compete in a solicitation for the utility owned.
That's right. There's an 80 megawatt cap for PPA projects. There is no such cap for utility owned projects. That's good for ratepayers, because larger projects will almost certainly be able to be delivered at lower cost.
Turn it over now to my colleague, Robert Josie. Yes. Questions for Ms. Miller? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Ms. Miller. How are you?
Good morning. Good.
I am going to try to keep my questions kind of in subject matter groups, so I may jump back and forth between your revised direct testimony, your supplemental testimony, and your rebuttal testimony. So if you have any questions on which one I'm referring to, just let me know.
Okay.
So on page 23 of your revised direct testimony, you mentioned that Pine Gate performed a power flow analysis. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And in your supplemental testimony, page 2, you discussed that the projects modeled in the power flow study, you modeled different projects in the power flow study. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Were there two power flow analysis done, or was it just one?
Just one.
Just one. And when was that power flow analysis done?
I believe it was conducted right around the time when we first mentioned it, and I can't recall if it was first mentioned in the direct testimony or the supplemental testimony.
But in July?
Correct. Yes, it was July. Pre-close of the transition cluster.
Pre-close, yes.
So
thank
before
you.
October.
So before October 31st, and yes, and obviously before today, which is the last day that projects can drop out of the transition cluster before the power flow study begins, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. And you state in your testimony that the power flow analysis that resulted in a $13 million upgrade if it were, you know, on a conservative basis, and a $16.84 million upgrade scenario on page 6 of your testimony. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And but Duke must complete its own study in order to come up with the final analysis of what the upgrades will be.
That is correct.
And those results will be what is used to determine the cost of Juno's final upgrades, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm going to switch over to discussing, I think Mr. Levitt said a little bit on this, but I just want to kind of follow up on some milestone payments and withdrawal penalties. On page 9 of your revised direct testimony, you state that the estimated construction cost of the facility is approximately $370,690,000. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And we heard from Mr. Levitis earlier that the study deposit for Juno was $250,000.
That's right, around $250,000.
And so the LGIA section 7.2.6 states that the penalty is 9 times the interconnection request total study cost imposed.
That's correct. So it would be around $2.25 million for Juneau if the full study cost were allocated.
And subject to check my math, $2.25 million would be approximately 0.6% of the total projected construction cost of the Juneau facility, correct?
That is correct. You may be getting at this point, but there, you know, from a development perspective, we do, you know, see the development expenditures for an earlier stage facility to be at risk and a question of risk exposure when there are still potential binary risks outstanding for the project that could ultimately kill the project or stop it from proceeding. So that $2.25 million could be $2.25 million absolutely lost for the facility, as opposed to the construction cost for the facility, which ultimately at that point, we would likely have a financial counterparty lined up, have obtained a construction loan for those costs, and at that point have obtained all necessary permits and approvals to build and operate the facility. So we would consider that all risk to be, you know, eliminated or fully de-risked at that point. So we do view a difference of at-risk exposures in the early stage of the development process versus the construction funds, which are procured through a construction lender.
Understood. And is it your understanding that the purpose of the transition cluster was to remove speculative projects from the queue in order for the cluster study to move forward in an expeditious manner?
It's my understanding that the transition cluster was intended for projects that had already been in queue for a while and were serious projects that intended to move forward.
You state on page 5 of your rebuttal testimony that you believe the uncertainty of whether the commission will grant a CPCN to a merchant facility might dissuade FERC jurisdictional interconnection customers from entering phase 2 of the study process due to the magnitude of the withdrawal penalties.
Correct.
And I would like to refer you to Miller Cross Exhibit 1, which I believe is entitled the Transition Cluster Phase 1 Customer Engagement Meeting. Do you have that in front of you?
I do. Yes.
I would like you to turn to page 7, 8, and 9, slide 7, 8, and 9, please. And particularly slide 9. This is the list of DEP transitional cluster projects. And I believe you can look through and correct me if I'm wrong, but all the FERC jurisdictional projects are within the transitional cluster are listed on page 3, slide 9 of the queue report.
Most of them, correct. It appears so.
Yes. And subject to check, there appear to be 8 FERC jurisdictional queued projects in the transition cluster.
Correct. I believe there may be one more further. There is one additional FERC project that's actually a battery on page 6, but otherwise that appears to be correct.
So yes, thank you. And of those 8 on page 3, 5 of them are in North Carolina.
Correct. It appears so.
And 2 are solar projects.
I believe there. Oh, 2 in North Carolina.
2 correct. In North Carolina are solar projects.
That's correct.
And the first one is a 275 megawatt project in Richmond County.
Correct. And that is Juneau Solar.
That would be Juneau. And the other one is a 69.9 megawatt project in Scotland County.
Correct. That is Frisian Solar.
That is Frisian. So those are the only 2 North Carolina FERC jurisdictional solar projects in the transition cluster.
Correct.
And Pine Gate has a development interest in both?
Correct. We are responsible for the development of both facilities.
And FERC, Frisian has already had a denied CPCN.
Correct. I believe it is currently going through the appeal process, but looking to Steve Levitis to confirm.
I'm sorry.
If needed. I don't think we need you right now, but just in case.
And on page 23 of your testimony, you say that the solution to the patently unfair and unreasonable situation is for the commission to issue conditional CPCNs?
Correct. We believe so.
Yes, and that patently unfair and unreasonable situation you're referring to is that Juno can't find out its system upgrade cost until it completes the study process?
It's the problem statement is the significant financial exposure that a FERC jurisdictional project like Juno would be subject to proceed in the transitional cluster process without knowing its interconnection system costs until quite far into that process, once significant financial payments are made.
Have projects in the past or other jurisdictions ever completed the study process without a CPCN?
I'm not sure I can speak to that accurately, but typically you do obtain a CPCN early on in the study process, from my experience.
But it is possible to complete the CPC or the study process without a CPCN.
I think it is possible, but the question of whether that is considered good business practice based on the risk exposure is a different question.
And you're aware that the study process, along with the milestone payments and the withdrawal penalties, were developed through a lengthy stakeholder process, as we discussed here today?
Correct.
And that the NCIP changes reflect those changes to the study process and were approved by this commission?
Correct.
Yes, and like the commission to take judicial notice of its order in E100 sub 101, the Q reform approval order on October 15th, 2020.
Without objection, the commission will take judicial notice.
And judicial notice that, and you are aware that FERC also approved this process as well?
Correct.
In the LG. Okay. And I'd like to take judicial notice of FERC's order accepting tariff revisions in ER21-1579-00 and ER21-1579-001 issued on August 6, 2021.
Without objection, the commission will take judicial notice.
I would like to point out on that point that I believe it was in Steve Levitis's test or rebuttal testimony that we did acknowledge this situation and potential issue for FERC jurisdictional projects during that process. And it was our understanding after discussions with the public staff that a conditional CPCN could be one way based on LCOT to solve that problem. So I believe in some ways there was reliance on prior discussions that would be solved.
And on page 3 of your rebuttal testimony, you state that a conditional CPCN would not eliminate all risk associated with the interconnection. The commission's issuance of a conditional CPCN to Juno would appropriately mitigate the substantial financial risk that Juno would face if it has to withdraw from the transitional cluster study, correct?
Correct.
And so is it your contention that that the commission must weigh the financial risk of applicants when determining whether to grant a CPCN?
I think it's our hope that the commission and the public staff will seek to find a what we would all consider a reasonable solution to an unintended problem.
And on page 5 of your rebuttal testimony, you state that the conditional CPCN with a $4 LCOT is designed to provide ample protection of ratepayers for ratepayers from unreasonably high network upgrade cost, correct?
Correct.
Is it your contention that anything over $4 is unreasonable in this situation?
I don't believe that we've contemplated that or that we're taking a position necessarily on what would be unreasonable beyond that threshold, but $4 is what we believe is a reasonable threshold for Juno Solar specifically.
Okay. Would an LCOT over $4 be unreasonable in any situation?
I think it's up to the commission and the public staff to view it on a case-by-case basis and determine what is justified for an individual merchant facility, since they are each facility, of course, is unique.
Madam Presiding Chair, at this time, I would like to ask some questions that may touch on confidential information.
Okay, do we need to clear the courtroom of anyone that has not signed a confidentiality agreement? And John, we're going to need to stop broadcasting. Yes. And actually, we're going to go off the record and give the court reporter a break. And we'll take a, so let's go off the record, Ms. Mitchell. It's adjourned for lunch. Let's come back at 2:05. Please go off the record.